have needs, and we cannot indefinitely defer their satisfaction. Now, let's just look for a moment. Suppose we could. Suppose that we were needful creatures. This is a technique which I often use, which you may or may not find useful, a pedagogical technique of examining alternatives to the actual configuration in order to understand the actual configuration better. That is to see what it would happen if we negate it. So suppose we were needful creatures, but we could choose when we satisfied our needs. In other words, we had the control to say, okay, I will ultimately have to satisfy this need, but I can choose when I want to satisfy. Well, then, the optimal strategy of life would be to defer action as long as possible. Because our minds are finite, because our knowledge is limited, we always act on partial information, right? I mean, we're always in the position, this is the existential position of the human being, we are always in the position of acting on partial information. This is why action takes courage, because we're always acting towards the unknown. Now, therefore, there's always a risk in action. There's always a risk in action. Of course, there's a risk in inaction, because inaction is a form of action. It's a choice of not acting. There's risk in that. I mean, the unknown is always there, whether we act in a certain way towards it or not. But the point is that, nonetheless, if we set out deliberately to plot a course of action, we gather information, we try to reduce the unknown and thus the potential threat as much as possible, but nonetheless, we can't eliminate it entirely. There's always a risk in action. And this is why it takes faith to act. This is why faith is necessary. Faith is the courage to act in the face of partial information. That's what faith is. So if we the perfect example of the person who has no faith is the catatonic schizophrenic, right? In other words, he is frozen into total inaction because he has no faith in any action that he can take, okay? So a total loss of faith would result in a total paralysis of action. However, the fact is that for most people, the courage to act is based simply on familiarity. In other words, the sun rises every day, so we assume that it's going to keep rising every day. All right. In other words, these regularities reduce the sense of threat. Every time we flip the light switch, the light comes on until the bulb burns out, and so on and so on, and we know what to do when the bulb burns out. And so on and so on. So it's these regularities, habituated regularities, which give us a false sense of security. That's why materialism is so innervating to the spiritual process, because it gives us a false sense of security. The only real sense of security derives from this relationship with God, because God is the only one who is in control of the whole thing. He's the only one who can eliminate whatever the real threat is out there. We may not even know what the real threat is, okay? Remember the prayer of the Bab that's in the new prayer book, you know, protect me from what lies above my head and below my feet and on one side and the other side and from every other side to which we were exposed. All the ways we were exposed that we don't even know we're exposed. Because how can we know? We have very partial information about what's going on. If we were needful creatures but could indefinitely defer the satisfaction of our needs, then the optimal life strategy would be to act only when absolutely necessary, to defer to the ultimate moment. Even if I'm 99% certain, why would I take even a 1% chance if I don't have to, if I can still wait? So you see, God has deliberately contrived the existential situation such that because of our needs, we are forced to act. We are forced to act. And we are forced to act on partial information, and therefore we need faith. We have to have the courage to act in the face of the unknown. Now, this doesn't mean that we shouldn't make an attempt to reduce the unknown. I mean, that's, again, knowledge, all right? But the point, the fact is that no matter how much knowledge we have, and in fact, in a certain sense, as science has shown, the more we know, the more we become aware of the vastness of the unknown. So knowledge of the known also increases the realization of awareness or knowledge, if you will, of the unknown. Of course, it's a logical paradox if you put it like that. To know the unknown is obviously a contradiction. But awareness of the vastness of the unknown, okay? So knowledge of the known increases our knowledge, i.e. awareness, of the unknown. So just getting more knowledge, even though it does in fact reduce the unknown, that which was previously unknown becomes known, nevertheless, it doesn't really remove the need for faith. In other words, the degree of knowledge is never going to remove the need for faith. And if you look, those who are intellectuals, those who pass their life dedicated to generating knowledge, are quite frequently those who are the least inclined to act and the least courageous to act. I mean, we're always very pleased when a great intellectual takes a stand in defense of somebody or something like that. I mean, intellectuals are afraid to risk their reputation by taking a stand in favor of something or somebody or some cause and so on and so on. So those people, if we take God out of the picture, in other words, those people who are the most knowledgeable are, generally speaking, those who are the least inclined to act and to act courageously. So amassing knowledge, even spiritual knowledge, will never become a substitute for faith. Faith is the courage to act in the face of the unknown. So where does faith come from? Where does this courage come from? It comes from this authentic relationship with God. It comes from this authentic relationship with God. Because God is the one who is in control of the whole thing. So, if I have this relationship with God, then I know two things: that God will protect me from that which is not for my benefit, and that those painful things and surprising things and upsetting things that happen to me are the will of God, and therefore for my benefit. So when they happen, I don't question. I don't start this cycle of saying, why did this happen to me? You know, why did, you know, God do this? I say, okay, you have sent this to me, it is for my benefit. I have to understand how it is for my benefit. So I don't go through the useless cycle of all these, I don't put into question the whole relationship with God. That's the fundamental of the whole thing. I simply take this as a task to understand what is the nature of the will of God in this particular instance. I had a very heartening experience. I'm not a dream type person, as you can tell, although I have a respectable intuition. I am, as you can tell, Well, let me say this. In a tablet which Abdu'l-Bahá wrote when he was 16 years old, which is a commentary on I Was a Hidden Treasure, this was in the Baghdad period, and a learned man, he wasn't a mullah, but he was a learned man, came to Baha'u'llah, and he said, would you please explain, elucidate the statement, the tradition of Muhammad, where he says, in the name of God, I was a hidden treasure and desired to be known, and hence I created thee. And Baha'u'llah immediately turned and said, the master will answer that. Abdu'l-Bahá was 16 years old. Whereupon he wrote, this is the earliest known tablet of the master. So he immediately wrote this tablet, which is in a very philosophical style, in which he explains this. And he explains this whole thing of the essence of God. Everything I've just said in the last almost hour was said. I mean, all about there's no differentiation on the level of the essence of God. All this is in this tablet. And in this, he says, he speaks about how the human being is endowed with this capacity to reflect all the attributes of God. And then he says, however, God hath ordained that every human soul has a dominant attribute. So he said, he has caused one of his names, one of his attributes, to be dominant in each human being. So you see, whereas the other levels of existence are determined by one attribute of God. In other words, the pinkness of this cover is the only attribute it has, in a certain sense. In other words, it's a pink thing, and that's what you can say about it from that point of view. As he says, he has caused everything to reflect one of his attributes. Here he says on page 65 of the Gleanings, upon the inmost reality of each and every created thing, he has shed the light of one of his names and made it a recipient of the glory of one of his attributes. Upon the reality of man, however, he has focused the radiance of all of his names and attributes and made it a mirror of his own self. So there it is. A mirror of his own self. Alone of all created things, man hath been singled out for so great a favor, so enduring a bounty. Okay. So again, we saw this. This is a logical definition of the human being. The human being is that unique thing in creation which has the capacity to reflect all the attributes of God. And as he says, each and every other created thing except man, he has shed the light of one of his names and made it the recipient of the glory of one of his attributes. However, in this tablet, Abdu'l-Bahá says that even though each human being does reflect all the attributes of God, these are in different proportions, as we saw yesterday, and he goes even further and he says that he has caused one of his names to be dominant in each human soul. Yes?
Okay, then yesterday we also touched on, we touched on this, and I think, if my understanding is correctly, that Baha'u'llah also said there is an appointed time for the fruition of certain bounties of an individual.
Sure.
So does that mean, or is it, could you assume that, the fruition of, establishing a genuine, authentic relationship with God or with others is based on the full growth and maturity of, manifesting according to one's own capacity the attributes of God?
Well, we'll talk more about this. This is a question that involves everything. So we will get into this. Okay. I will defer talking about this for the moment. What I'm still trying to do is establish the ultimate parameters of this thing, that which is universal. So anyway, what I wanted to say was that quite clearly my dominant attribute could be said to be logic or something along that line. I mean, I've spent my whole life pursuing logic. But I do have an intuition at some level. As I say, I'm not a dream person. But my father died about 15 years ago. He was not a Baha'i when he died. I mean, he was not consciously a believer. But in any case, I'm convinced that he is a believer in the next life. And so a few months ago, I had a dream of my father, and he was extremely powerful in the dream. He was recognizable as my father, but he was totally transformed. I mean, he was very powerful. And I say this because my father was an extremely gentle man, not weak, but gentle. He was an extraordinarily gentle person. So power, in other words, is not gentleness and kindness are attributes that everyone would have attributed to my father. But power, you wouldn't have thought of, you know, this is a powerful man. But in this dream, he was very powerful. So I asked him, what is going to happen to me? And he said, I can't tell you what is going to happen to you. And the sense of it was not that I don't know, but that I'm not permitted to tell you, okay? He says, I can't tell you what's going to happen to you, but I can assure you that everything that happens to you is the will of God. And shortly thereafter, I had the greatest test of the last 10 years of my existence. And I mean, it was very difficult, but I was able to pass through it because precisely I recall this dream. So my father had, on behalf of Baha'u'llah undoubtedly, given me just this knowledge that was necessary to reassure me that, okay, this is the will of God. And so it was much easier. In other words, I said, okay, this is the will of God. My father told me, so that's it. And so I was able to get through this test reasonably. I mean, I'm still recovering from it, but I was able to get through it. So you see, this is the nature of the dialogue with God. In other words, how there's no knowledge, no rational knowledge that one could have that would have prepared me for this. I mean, because it was totally out of the blue, it was totally unexpected. There is no rational way, there was no information that I possessed that could have possibly, you know, prepared me for this. I mean, there's absolutely no way, okay? I mean, I could have been the most intelligent, the most sensitive, the most far-seeing person in the world. I simply did not have the information that would allow me to know that this thing was going to happen. There was no way I could prepare for this, you see. So this is just a little example, but you see, this is the important thing. We cannot be successful without establishing this relationship with God, because only God has the knowledge. Only God can protect us from these things. Only God can guide us through these things. We simply can't do it. We'll destroy ourselves if we try to do these things without this relationship with God. You know, you simply destroy yourself. You can't do it. So, I hope that I have convinced you that the whole basis of moral and spiritual development is establishing this authentic relationship with God. There is no other way. This is the meaning of religion. And if we don't do this, we simply miss the meaning of the whole thing. I mean, we will stay on a certain level and so on and so on, but you will never really get the fruit of what it's all about. So, as I say, we can say that God is good, that God is all wise, that God is all powerful, and this is true. These are all true things. But these are metaphorical truths. In other words, to say that God is good means that the best idea of goodness that we can have is some kind of approximation to what God is. are the greatest conception of what knowledge is something like what God is. But the only thing we can say that is not a metaphor, but that is literally scientifically true, is to say that God is God. I am that I am, as it says to Moses in the Old Testament. God is God. I mean, this is the only absolutely true propositional statement about God. God's essence is God's essence. There's nothing else like it. You see, when we use metaphor, what we use is comparison, right? This beautiful girl is like a lovely flower, okay? We're not saying that the girl is a flower. We're using a comparison of beauty, perfume, and so on. All of these, we're evoking these comparisons, you see. And so there are many ways in which a beautiful woman can be legitimately compared to a beautiful flower, okay? And so on and so on. But there is nothing to which God can be legitimately compared, because God is the incomparable. He cannot be compared with anything else. Now, so the existential situation is that we have to act. And we have to act in the face of uncertainty, and therefore it needs faith to act, which is just courage. And the only source of this courage is God. The fear of God, if you will. In other words, if we fear God, that recognizes that God has power over us. If we fear God, then we lose our fear of all these other things, because we realize they can't hurt us, but God can. Okay? God can if he wants to. Why would he hurt us? He would hurt us for our benefit. I mean, causes pain for our benefit. That's what we call a test, right? But we have it. Now, if we think about, for the moment, horizontal relationships, I've forgotten what time are we going to? To 11, okay. If we think about horizontal relationships, between human beings, are relationships between needful creatures. In other words, if we have here A who is human and B who is also human, then this is a relationship between two needful creatures. So every human relationship involves a certain amount of self-interest. Okay? Every human relationship involves a certain degree of self-interest, because we're needful creatures. So every human love, no human love is absolutely pure. Now, there are relative degrees of purity, and the difference between these relative degrees is very great, obviously. The difference between a psychopath who does nothing but manipulate people and a self-sacrificing servant of the servant is immense. Nonetheless, even the most perfect of human beings has a certain ego, a certain degree of self-interest in the love that he has. This is the human condition. Okay, so we are used to this fact. In other words, we are used to the fact that there's a certain degree of self-interest in human relationships. Now, how does this influence our relationships with each other? Well, the point is this. We are each, to some extent, manipulating others in order to satisfy our needs. I mean, maybe it's just something as simple as we would like the approval of somebody else, like them to say we did a good job or whatever. It could be something very simple, very trivial, not, you know, some gross evil, or we're trying to manipulate them to give us all their money or something like that. But nonetheless, we want things from other people, and we manipulate them in subtle ways to get these things, and they're doing the same thing to us. So this manipulation, this element of manipulation, is in all human relationships. And so this leads us to act in certain ways with each other. So if we, an authentic relationship A relationship is authentic to the degree that this manipulation is absent. In other words, the pursuit of authentic relationships between human beings means progressively eliminating this manipulative aspect. In other words, we satisfy our needs legitimately in our relationship with God, and to the degree that we satisfy our needs legitimately, we don't have to satisfy our needs through other people, and therefore we have love to give them. We can love them and serve them rather than trying to take from them by manipulating them. Okay? So this is the way that it's supposed to go. This is what the pursuit of authenticity is. So now we get to the point is that the importance of our relationship with God lies in the fact that this is the only relationship we have with another subject who has no needs and therefore whom we cannot manipulate. You see, how do I manipulate you? Well, it's an implicit bargain, right? I will satisfy certain of your needs if you will satisfy certain of my needs. How does a child, look, a child is weak and vulnerable. He has no physical power over the parents. I mean, the parents can abuse, kill the child if they want, right? And yet we see all the time that children manipulate parents. How do they do this? Well, by threatening to withhold their approval of the parents, for example. The parents love the children, but they also want the return of love. You know, sharper than a serpent's tooth is an ungrateful child, right? I mean, we spoke yesterday of all the sacrifices that the mother makes for the child. So obviously, in a certain sense, the parent is in the position of giving and the child is in the position of receiving. But the parent nonetheless needs the fact that the child does in fact receive this love. If the child rejects this love, for example, doesn't receive it, is in no wise grateful for it, this hurts the parent. So even though the parents have the power and the child does not, the child nevertheless can manipulate the parent. Why? Because the parent has needs. Because the parent has need. So our needs are handles that other people can use to manipulate us. And we do the same thing with them. We use their needs. We sort of say, you know, what does this person want from me? And if I give him that, then, you know, it's this kind of bargain. But you can't do that with God, because God doesn't have any needs. God is the all-sufficing. You see, this is the proof that God's love for us is absolutely pure. This is why we know that everything that God does is for our benefit, because he has no self-interest. He has no benefit to get out of it. Remember, Baha'u'llah says, do you think that your perversity can harm him, or that he has need of your worship? You know, holy for your sake, we call you. Okay, it is all for our sake. All of these laws and principles in the Kitab-i Aqdas, everything else, it is for us. It is not for God. He doesn't need any of this. So God is without needs. But this is the fact that God is without needs is the assurance that God's love for us is absolutely pure. There is no self-interest on the part of God. So that, of course, is the good news. But if you will, the bad news, or the thing which we perceive negatively, is that we cannot in any wise manipulate God. We cannot manipulate God. We can threaten to, you know, withhold our approval from God or whatever. We can do all of the manipulative acts towards God, but they will not manipulate God, because God is the unmanipulatable. And so we need that. This, again, is why it is impossible to have a truly authentic relationship between two human beings without each of these human beings having an authentic relationship with God. Because this is the only relationship we have there. Our relationship with God is unique among all the relationships we have because it is the only relationship we have in which manipulation is totally absent. Okay? God is not manipulating us. He's totally honest with us. He tells us what he wants to do. You want to know what God wants? There, look, read the Ketubot Yachdos, you know. Do this, don't do that. He's telling you right away. He's not, you know, saying, I'm going to play around with you, you know. Here are the consequences, you know. You want to commit adultery? Commit adultery. There is a humiliating torment in the next life. Okay, I'm telling you. There's a humiliating torment in the next life. You know, of course, there's a fine that you have to pay, but after all, most people don't commit adultery in the street. You know, if one takes a few precautions, one could presumably get away with adultery without it being discovered, right? You know, if one would say the only punishment or a negative consequence of adultery would be if you're found out and have to pay this fine, well, you know, you could sort of make a calculation about that and say, well, okay, you know, I can get away with this, or I have a reasonable, I'm willing to take the risk, you know. But there it is, he's saying, and by the way, you know, whether or not you're discovered, whether or not, you know, there's a humiliating torment in the next life, okay? So God isn't manipulating. He's just telling you, laying out, there it is, you know. Yes?
I was wondering if you'd be able to just then elaborate on the famous hidden word, love me that I may love thee.
The what?
Love me that I may love thee, if thou lovest me not.
Well, that's exactly what we had talked about. The whole thing is we have to have an authentic relationship with God. A relationship is a covenant. It goes both ways. If we don't love God, you know, God can love us all he wants, but if we don't love him back, then there's no relationship. So that hidden word, love me that I may love thee, is exactly that. It's saying you have to establish the authentic relationship. Let's see what Shoghi Effendi says about our response. You see, this is the whole point. You see, the Christian notion of salvation, and just open the TV set and listen to any one of these preachers and he'll tell you, right? The Christian notion of salvation is that salvation is a unidirectional gift from God to man, right? In other words, you are a sinner, you are in degradation, Jesus died for your sins, you accept Jesus as your personal Lord and Savior, and you are saved. So this is a unidirectional gift. I mean, that's the terms they use. This is a gift from God. You can't earn it. You are corrupt. You cannot possibly earn it. And so on and so on. Now, so let's see what Baha'u'llah says. What Baha'u'llah says is that salvation is not a unidirectional gift, but a relationship which is conditioned on an adequate response on our part. Okay? And without that adequate response, there is no authentic relationship. Well, let's read a couple of passages here. Okay? Let's talk about this. I have to find it. I'll find it in a second. Thank you. Okay. It starts on page 205 and 206. It's under the essay that's the concept of spirituality. Well, let me start by reading the strongest statement of it, and then I'll read other statements. Personal effort, says page 206. This is from The Guardian. Personal effort is indeed a vital prerequisite to the recognition and acceptance of the cause of God. No matter how strong the measure of divine grace, unless supplemented by personal, sustained, and intelligent effort, it cannot become fully effective and be of any real and abiding advantage. So he says, no matter how great the grace. Now, what the Christians talk about, the grace, amazing grace, right? That has saved a wretch like me. Right? You know this? Amazing grace. You know that? No? Okay? So, saved by grace. I mean, this is the whole theme of Christian, right? Christian salvation is, it is by the grace of God that you're saved. Well, of course, that's true as far as it goes. But the relationship as it is pictured is one like an adult to a child, right? That the child, the adult gives and the child simply receives and that's it. But what Baha'u'llah wants is mature partners in dialogue with God, okay? This is the age of the maturity of the human being, so God is no longer treating us as children who simply have to receive the gifts. Well, let's read it again. Personal effort is indeed a vital prerequisite to the recognition and acceptance of the cause of God. No matter how strong the measure of divine grace, so it doesn't matter how great God is. God is the all-loving. He's the all-gracious. He's infinitely, absolutely loving. But no matter how loving God is, unless supplemented by personal, that means you have to do it. You can't depend on somebody else. Sustain, this means one romantic burst of effort will not do it. It has to be sustained. And intelligent effort, this means that just, you know this thing about heart Baha'is and head Baha'is, you know, just being a heart Baha'i and saying, okay, I'm going to, instead of thinking about these things because it's so terribly difficult to think about them, I will just substitute thought with my devotion to the faith. Well, that's not going to do it. It has to be personal, sustained, and intelligent effort. It cannot become fully effective and be of any real and abiding, lasting advantage. So this is, again, life is a dialogue with God. This authentic relationship with God is a relationship. We are created to be partners in dialogue with God, you see? And this is the purpose of not only of our existence, but the whole of creation. Having created the world and all that liveth and moveth therein, he, through the direct operation of his unconstrained and sovereign will, chose, he didn't have to do it, he chose to confer upon man the unique distinction and capacity, to know him and to love him. Now, listen to this. A capacity that must needs be regarded as the generating impulse and the primary purpose underlying the whole of creation. So, this pursuing this authentic relationship is not just the purpose of our lives, it's the purpose of the whole thing. Remember, we saw yesterday that the human soul is the only thing that progresses. God and the manifestations don't progress because they don't have to, and the material world doesn't progress because the material world is simply constant motion within fixed limits. It never progresses. But, so, the whole of creation, the purpose of the whole thing, from beginning to end, all the levels, the infinity of worlds, the infinity of manifestation, the whole purpose of it is to allow, to create an arena, to create the proper conditions under which the human soul can progress. And how does the human soul progress? It progresses in dialogue with God. So it takes an active response on our part. Not a passive response, an active, sustained, personal, and intelligent. Okay.